Offering opening the show was Choose Love by Laura Kane, because our topic tonight is love cures, healing and love magic in old French romance with Professor Lane Doggett from St. Mary's College in Maryland. Then after our chat, in about an hour, we'll have returning to the show Z Budapest and her partner Bobby Grenier, who'll update us on the tribute they're planning for Merlin Stone, our beloved deceased foremother, author of When God Was a Woman, a book that changed so many lives. But before we get to those important subjects, I have to ask if you've been following the news. I know sometimes we want to just bury our heads because we just can't take it anymore, but if you've been listening over the past weeks, you've heard the shows I've done with Leah Burton and Rachel Tabachnik about the fundamentalist dominionist Christians, no doubt. Well, the YouTube clips and stories are everywhere now. I don't know if it's just me that's suddenly noticing it, but I think not. I think this stuff has really started to go viral. They're everywhere. Seems Michelle Bachmann's business, she's so proud of, that she owns with her husband, a clinic, has been getting taxpayer dollars to cure gays using methods that have been discredited by medical associations, and they've collected over $160,000 from taxpayers, and that doesn't even count the bundle her family's gotten in farm subsidies from our tax dollars. Yet she's all about small government till she wants her hand out or to tell someone else how to live their life. And don't even get me going on her warped views of history. She thinks the founding fathers helped rid the country of slavery when they were actually slave owners. And Rick Perry, governor of Texas, who will probably announce soon he's running for president, and some really believe he has a better chance at the GOP nomination than Michelle Bachmann, well, he's about to do a stadium prayer meeting to pray away our government problems. And he's associated with people who call themselves apostles, who are saying things like, the emperor of Japan caused the stock market crash because he had sex with the sun goddess, who they call a demon. They're also calling the Statue of Liberty, which many of us see as an archetype of the political goddess of freedom, another demon. And wait for it, Oprah. We all know Oprah. She is the harbinger of the Antichrist. All right, I know it sounds like these crazies are just that, but these are people who are in with those who have passed more than 900 bills since November to take away rights from women and worker rights. They would destroy the separation between church and state in a fast minute. How long before, if they got into power, they'd have some sort of purity test for everything to see if you were a real American by being their brand of Christian. Go back and listen to some of the interviews I've done with Rachel Tabachnik and Leah Burton, who talks about fundamentalism in the military, and what people have started to call these T-evangelicals, whose mission it is to take over the seven mountains of our culture. And the scary part is these people's numbers are growing. You need to know they're out there and what they're up to. They are very anti-goddess and definitely anti-woman. Just a couple quick announcements. First, Sacred Sundays is starting up again at the Green Man in Hollywood on July 24th and continuing for each consecutive fourth Sunday. You can check out the details on my webpage, KarenTate.com. Go to the Sacred Sundays button and see what that's all about. We've been on hiatus for a bit, but now we're back. And we have sort of interfaith services that couple the sacred feminine and divine masculine, particularly with the idea that there is no one way. So come out and say hello. I'm one of the facilitators, and it would be great to meet you. Also, the annual Isis birthday Mediterranean feast is set for July 31st, and we only have four spots left. So if you're thinking of coming, don't delay any longer. We've been celebrating the birthday of our great mother for almost a decade each July, and we continue the tradition, but this time with a feast instead of a tea. And the subject, the theme of the day is going to be gratitude. And if you're interested in joining us, it's going to be in Hawthorne, which is in Southern California. Just email me. I'm happy to give you details, the menu, the cost, and the location. But that brings tonight's announcements and comments to a close as we get to our interesting guest, Professor Lane Doggett. Let me tell you a little bit about her before we start what I'm sure is going to be an interesting chat. Lane Doggett is Associate Professor of French and Chair of the Department of International Languages and Cultures at St. Mary's College of Maryland. The college, located in St. Mary's City, Maryland, is a freestanding honors college of the state of Maryland. Doggett teaches a variety of French classes there and researches topics related to medieval French literature, especially the genre of romance. She also sometimes guest lectures in women's studies. She holds a BA from Wofford College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and an MA and PhD from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's taught at Erskine College in Due West, South Carolina, and the Harriet L. Wicks Honors College of Florida Atlantic University. She's published articles and the book that we're going to talk about tonight, Love Cures, Healing and Love Magic in Old French Romance. And I believe it was published by University Park, and in University Park, Pennsylvania, by Pennsylvania State University Press. And that just came out in 2009, so it's a pretty new book. So, Lane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, Lane, let's start off by asking you, how did this book, how were you inspired to write this?
Well, I always tell my students that you have to find a research question that where something bothers you, it stays with you, it digs at you. And what I found when I was reading a lot of different examples of medieval literature is that there were examples of magic, love magic, other kinds of magic, and also healing. And these just wouldn't leave me alone. They kept staying with me and bringing up questions, things like, who are these women? How did they do these things? How did people perceive them? How did people understand their knowledge? And specifically interested in what their knowledge, how it gave them advantages, how could they use it in terms of power and influence.
Oh, I want to hear about all of that.
Okay. So those were the questions that got me started on this project.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Was it, the first thing that comes to mind to me is, I'll bet it was hard to find this information, was it? Because I would imagine people of the times were not that literate, or am I under the wrong impression?
Well, I was looking at specifically at literary texts that we have, obviously, from the Middle Ages. Many of them were probably lost. But the things that, and some of them are in fragments. I mean, we don't have complete texts for some of them. So in terms of what's left in medieval literature, the body of medieval literature is enormous, and some of it has probably never been looked at in modern times. So there's a lot that's been edited in modern collections, so I didn't have to go. I didn't do a project where I went back and looked at manuscripts. I looked at texts that were published and that, were, for the most part, within the field, are pretty well known. And there are, this literature is just full of examples of all kinds of magic acts. And then the other thing that helped the project is that there has been a lot of work done on the history of magic, and so that served as a background to get the information. So it wasn't as hidden as one might think, but as I got into it, these women, basically these characters that I analyze in these stories, nobody had written specific articles or books about them. They had written about these works, but nobody had paid much attention to them. They had primarily just tossed them off with a label, she's a witch, whatever, and then kept moving. And they hadn't made any discussion of them because they just didn't seem to give them much credence or much credit for their work. And so they were kind of ignored. I mean, in the reading that I began to do, I did have to dig for thinking about who they were, because people would label them and then just move on but not really talk about them.
Okay. Well, and we know, you know, that word witch is such a loaded word. What were these women, really? You know, if we get away from with the church propaganda of the word witch.
So in order to unpack that, it takes a little bit of time. First of all, I will say that in the different stories that I was analyzing, the word witch is almost never used. So it's been used by modern literary critics, and as a researcher of literature, those are the people that I'm in dialogue with. So I'm responding to the things that they have said already in the past. And so these stories will sometimes use the word doctor to describe these characters, but this is a time when in northern France at the University of Paris, the medical school is just beginning. So we don't have this assumption that you have to have a degree to use the word doctor. Doctor can be used by lots of people, whether they have formal training or informal training. And so one of the things that's really important to understand about these works is that these practitioners, even though they're informally trained, they are, according to historians of medicine, they use the same techniques as the doctors who were formally trained at the time in the 12th century. There's this
so
body.
We're not necessarily talking about midwives who are out, you know, using herbal remedies. We're talking beyond that.
We are talking the descriptions in the text that I look at definitely show they never use the word midwife. So these stories don't show any. So if you think of midwife, I usually think of, you know, a woman who specifically helps with childbirth. That isn't depicted in these stories. There's very little mention a woman will give birth and they celebrate it because it continues the line, the family line. Of course, that's very important. And it helps for the stability of the king's family, the prince's family, that kind of thing. So it's important. But they're not ever called midwives. They are healers, and they seem to be in a tradition of healing. Whether they would have participated in childbirth activities is hard to say because again, I'm working with what's presented in literary texts, and the literary texts give lots of information on certain topics and completely gloss over others. So I don't have any examples of midwife.
So are these women from upper stratas of society, or, you know, just sort of the old lady down the road in the little shack? Or give us a picture of who these women healers are.
They are, in the stories that I'm working with, they're specifically what would be in the aristocracy. And the reason is because these stories were written down for the court. They were the entertainment of the time. They would be composed to be sung sometimes or to be spoken, performed at court. And these are the stories of knights and ladies, of Lancelot and Guinevere, of the court of King Arthur, of other courts. And so we are squarely in aristocratic literature, and the genre of romance is primarily aristocratic. It is very interested in the politics of the time, which have to do with the king or the prince or the duke at court, and the ladies who were there with the knights who have to quest for adventure, show their strength, but also show refinement in courtly behavior and chivalry, that kind of thing.
So we're not talking a time when patriarchy has not really oppressed women quite so much, at least not the women of the aristocracy. I'm not good with dates, I'll admit it, and I'm thinking about the movie Pope Joan.
Okay.
I don't remember what time period that was from, and I'm just trying to get a picture of what it might have been like, you know, and who these women actually were. So for the most part, your research dealt with the aristocracy because they're the ones that had all that had the scribes and who were doing the writing, I suppose.
These texts were probably written for an aristocratic audience, and so, you know, they deal with the concerns and issues of the day, with rebellious barons who show up at court. A lot of questions about marriage, because marriage is a very political. It's not about two people falling in love. It's a very political question, because we're going to align families through love, through marriage. I'm sorry. And so, love is not an important concern. In fact, the economy, the family's dynastic interests are the more important thing. So yes, it's a very limited slice of life. There's some other literary texts of the time that are considered less aristocratic, but they're short stories, so you don't get as much character development, you don't have as much internal thought, so it's harder to tell how they might reflect or interact with the society.
Well, and maybe this is a good segue for this question, because in your book title you refer to romance.
Okay.
But from what you just said, you know, maybe not romance in the sense that we think about romance. So tell us, what do you mean by romance? Is it different than our interpretation?
Yes, it's quite different, because, you know, today we talk about romance novels that primarily women read, and you know, there can be a case made that they are far derivative from medieval romance. But medieval romance is one of the different genres of literature. Normally when we talk about literature today, we were going to divide it into poems, plays, and prose. But in medieval literature, we'll use a little bit more refined analysis to break down the genres. And so romances are longer. That's the first aspect of them, because romance is actually the precursor of the modern novel. You do get internal thought. You do get character development, and you can see this as leading to the novel that we have today. They are first written down in verse, which attests to their oral origins, because the performer would have learned them to perform at court, and verse is, of course, easier to remember than somebody who has to learn prose. They later are written in prose. And so that's part of their form. And then their content is this aristocratic content of they're going to be performed at the court of a king, a prince, a duke, someone like that. So the content, as I said, it deals with knights and ladies, with adventure and honor, any aspect of court politics, a lot of love and how that interferes with what's going on at the court or enhances it in some cases. So a couple of examples I mentioned earlier, Lancelot and Guinevere. People have heard of the story of Tristan, and her German name is Isolde, her French name is Iser. So romance is a little bit in contrast to something like an epic that's like Beowulf or the Song of Roland or even the movie Braveheart. Braveheart is a classic epic, because epic is usually just a war story, but it's one that has a definition that defines a national identity. So Scotland is defined as an identity in the movie Braveheart, for example. So romances have fewer battles, unlike epic, but they have all this other court intrigue. And they intersect in complicated ways with court life. Sometimes they try to teach. Sometimes they try to set up ideals. They question what's going on in society. So we can't just say, oh, it happened in the story, so medieval society must look like this. It's not that simple, because any novel that we read today can be written to cause us to ask questions about what's going on and to think it through, as opposed to simply saying it's as simple as X.
Okay. So am I understanding you right, as you were, you know, doing this research into, you know, these type of stories of the time, you stumbled across a lot of these women who were healers, who indulged in doing love magic. Is that how this came to be?
Yes, exactly. That's it.
Okay. And now... I think this is really interesting and curious, but some might say, why would anyone care about medieval literature today? Why is it important for us to maybe look back at this?
Well, I, of course, having spent many years studying it and reading it, I'm fascinated by it, but I realize that not everyone is, so I have my little soapbox speech. And the more you spend time with medieval literature, the more that you see that we are completely and inexplicably tied to it. We are, in some ways, still in the same place. There are many ways in which society has moved on, but much of what you read about resonates with today. And so, like I said earlier about romance, the portrayal of internal thoughts, emotions, struggles, this is the basis for the novels that we read today. So this literature gives us certain forms, but it also gives us content. It's full of love stories. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that the way that love is represented in these stories, specifically from the 12th and 13th century, influences how we think about love today. In other words, it wasn't there before the 12th, 13th century. You can compare it to texts from earlier times. Ovid is always used as an example of how to look at love. And there are Ovidian influences on this medieval literature, but there are new, fundamentally new ways of depicting romantic love. And they show up in what we think, how we describe love today. So my favorite examples are from song lyrics, for example. You have titles like Love Hurts, or song lyrics such as Love is a Drug, or Love Potion Number 9, or Sexual Healing. And all of these specific ideas in these songs can be traced back to 12th and 13th century literature that was first written down in French and then later translated and adapted into English and German and Spanish and Italian and other European languages. So you really, if you want to understand how we got to our specific ideas about Western notion of romantic love, you kind of have to read medieval literature. And people are put off a little bit sometimes because there's unfamiliar language, there's social structures like feudalism that they find strange and off-putting. But on the other hand, a lot of people are really drawn to medieval literature. And you can see this because there's, you know, this constant fascination in our society with a medieval or a Renaissance festival or fair. There's rewrites, there's movies, there's video games, everything in terms of movies from First Night to Beowulf. I mentioned Braveheart earlier, films about the Crusades. And then there are, of course, it's important to read the literature of the time, but also their reinterpretations. And these started as soon as the Middle Ages were over, with Milton's Paradise Lost. And then we have T.S. White's The Once and Future King, a rewrite of the Arthurian legend. Another rewrite of the Arthurian legend, obviously, Marion Zimmer Bradley's The Mists of Avalon.
Mm-hmm,
and, of course, Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. So there's this fascination in our culture with going back to medieval models of literature and rewriting for modern times. But I also feel like it's important to go back and read the original text to see how they're different from what we are reading and what's available to us today.
Well, it sort of begs the question then, what was love like before then? Love or romance, and maybe romance isn't the right word because it confuses the issue, but
right.
What were relationships like before? I mean, was it just the situation where women were more chattel, or, you know, just sort of a political pawn to, you know, bring two houses together or something?
Well, if you're looking at literary models, it's hard to get at descriptions of love in other kinds of historical documents. But if you're looking at literature, if we go back to the before the Middle Ages into Roman and Greek literature, so Ovid is often used because Ovid is a strong model for the Middle Ages, and the idea of love sickness that Ovid describes shows up in medieval literature. But what happens in Ovid, Ovid is writing for a Roman, very cultivated, sophisticated city population, not living at land courts that are separate, you know, that aren't around cities. And love in Ovid's works is really just a game. There's a certain madness that people, it's often described as a madness. But it's not, people, again, at this time, they marry, there have been a number of people who've done work on Roman marriage and Roman families. They marry again, the aristocracy clearly, for dynastic interests. And then they seem to play around, and that's the thing that Ovid describes a lot in his works. And so it's more lust at that point. And there's not a sense with the Tristan and Isolde story, you have this idea of these two lovers who need to be together for their whole lives, who if they're separated, they are in misery. And,
they're soulmates.
Right, exactly.
Okay. All right. So, well, let's sort of get into the healing and the love magic that, you know, that you uncovered as you were doing this research in the 12th and the 13th century. I think that's probably a big part of what my listeners want to hear about.
Sure.
What did it consist of? I mean, what did it look like?
The healing is often after a wound, and sometimes from battle, and so it is, they will use a poultice of different kinds, they'll prepare herbal remedies, and there will be all of the examples, I'm trying to think if there are any other examples, all of the examples are wounds following battles. Some of them can be poisoned. For example, in one story, there's a poison sword that's used to wound the fighter. And the healer has to understand, this is the story of Tristan, actually. Tristan is wounded in battle. And he seeks out doctors, and none of them can cure him. And this wound is rotting, and it's causing him quite a lot of distress. And he was told when he was wounded with the sword that he would have to go to, only one person would know how to heal it, and that was the sister of the man who wounded him. And he eventually killed this man, so he can't simply go to her. He has to disguise himself and give out a different name. And so she recognizes that the wound is poisoned and understands what kind of plant substance might provide an antivenin and prepares it. And the text goes into great detail. It talks about how she cuts away the dead flesh around the wound. So she does this minor surgery, and she makes a poultice. And so we get all these specific details about kinds of healing that are going on. The other stories are less specific, but it always has to do with either some kind of poisoning or wounding. So, again, we're talking about using different plants at the time, understanding how they work. There are a number of herbals that are available in the Middle Ages. Some of them are in Latin, so that would be the language of learning, but others of them are in the languages that other people spoke, so they could be written in English, they could be written in French. And then some of them, there are some herbals that are written in verse, and this suggests that some people didn't, not everyone, not all the users would have read them. Some people would have learned it by rote, because, again, being in verse means that it's easier to remember. So this healing lore had come down using plants from historians of medicine who have looked at this, have traced these pharmacological applications of plants from Greek times. And so you have Greek herbals, and then what they describe is that there's not a lot of change over time. Obviously, there are going to be some plants in Greece that aren't available in northern France or England, for example. And so certain things will be added over time. But there's a pretty standard pharmacopoeia that is used, and there's a pretty good understanding of, when you look at herbals, when you look at the different recipe books that are available, there's a pretty good understanding of plants and the effects that they cause.
Well, were you a little bit surprised, and if I'm understanding you right, that there wasn't so much written about, say, for instance, women's ailments, you know, just all of the issues women go through with, you know, the uterus and bleeding.
Wow.
And, because, you know, I had a guest on the show, David Hillman, who translated ancient Greek himself. And one of the reasons he came on the show is because he had found so much information about the women in Greek society who were these great pharmacologists, and that had sort of been missing from women's studies. And it seems like, at least in this time period, the healing is, you know, like you said, revolves around an injury, maybe a knight or somebody who was in battle, or or like you said, a poisoning, but yet not so much about, you know, things that were related to women.
No, not in these stories. I mean, romance as a genre, and not really in any in other literary examples that I can think of, romance as a genre certainly deals with social issues of the day, but it's still primarily, first and foremost, written to entertain people. So it's not going to go into great detail about healing. There's even one point in the text where there is this, where the narrator intercedes and says, well, I don't want to go into too much detail because it's unseemly for a courtly audience to hear.
I see.
So
they're talking
that,
about the knights being healed, because that's like, you know, what's the word? I mean, it's valor, and it's,
right.
You know, it's all of this knightly conquest and things that the men are beating their chests about, as opposed to women's stuff.
Right.
Okay.
But it's also interesting, though, because the women healers, they are described as being very knowledgeable. And so romance does tend to exaggerate. It's always the best knight who fights who defeats all the other knights. It's never halfway. And so the women are described in equally positive terms. They'll be the wisest in the land. So when Tristan is healed from the sword wound, all these other doctors who some of whom are described as men, are incapable of helping him because they don't understand that the wound is poison. And when he goes to Ireland to seek help, because he's been told that's the only way he can ever resolve this problem, the woman that heals him is described as extremely wise, and so in very positive terms, and very learned.
Okay. Well, and what's the religious backdrop at the time? I would imagine it's probably Christianity, or does that even enter the picture?
It does in romance, but it is the backdrop. It is sort of the same way that capitalism is the backdrop of our society.
Okay.
And so you will read, sometimes people are surprised when I start talking about these stories because they're so focused on romantic earthly love, and they will say, well, you know, wasn't the Middle Ages just about a love for God? And, you know, there's an enormous, as I said before, variety of medieval literature, and a lot of it doesn't focus on the other world. It focuses on the here and now. And, you know, human emotion plays a huge role in that. And the effects that people go through as a result of all these courtly intrigues. And, you know, the suggestion has been made that as feudalism evolves, you have too many knights. And so, you know, you're dealing with real social problems. There aren't enough women for them to marry because the person who marries has to have land, et cetera. And so there are real social concerns that are being reflected in this literature.
Okay.
And so religion is kind of there. I mean, it will say they went to mass first thing in the morning, but that's it.
Well, and I'm just curious too, if we're talking about, you know, love and magic, and, you know, it sort of makes my mind go to sex or erotica. Was that sort of ever veiled in these romance stories?
Yes, absolutely. Because, I mean, when you're talking about love magic, that's really the heart of the story of Tristan and Isolde, is that Isolde is supposed to marry the King of Cornwall. She is a princess of Ireland, and this is a marriage that is supposed to cement peace between the two lands who have been feuding. And so she has this arranged marriage for political ends, but she falls in love with Tristan because they drink this love potion. And so she will go ahead and marry Mark because she's set up to marry him, but then she continues to have this adulterous love affair, which is described in great detail about their meetings, and it will never come right out and say they had sex, but it'll say they took pleasure in each other, and those kinds of things. So especially in the 12th and 13th century, literature tends to be fairly open about sexuality, So you do see that in the literature.
We'll talk a little bit more about the love magic.
Okay.
You just said something about a potion, but you know, what other sorts of love magic did they do?
The primary one is this love potion, and then there's another long story in which, again, a woman is married to a man that she does not love. She loves another man, and she's given different potions. The man that she marries that she doesn't love. So she goes through with the marriage as she's supposed to. And so the story that I'm describing is called Cligès, and it was written down by a French guy who wrote 5 different romances, which is more than we have from anyone else. His name is Chrétien. So Chrétien writes a number of romances in the 12th century. And in this one, he describes how she is married to this man that she does not love, and her lady-in-waiting prepares a potion for him that makes him dream. It's a hallucinogenic potion that he's having sex with her. So he dreams that he consummates the marriage, but he, in fact, never does. And so she saves herself for the man that she really loves. She's given another potion later that enables her to fake her death. So these are related to love magic because they are having to do with, you know, getting to the man that you love. And so the second potion, she is spirited away as a dead person and goes away to live with the man that she loves after considerable complications, of course, because that makes for a good story.
So in other words, all right, well, so they're really using, like you said, hallucinogens. Probably the one that made her look like she was dead was probably, you see that in the movies all the time, you know,
right.
it looks like it brings on death, shallow breathing, whatever, and they think the people are dead. So really they were using, probably local herbs, the pharmacology of the time, as opposed to magic.
Right.
Okay, so we're not talking in terms of like the Ephesian letters or the Hebrew letters or anything like that that was supposed to carry some magical power. We're talking about pharmacology I'm thinking that's not really magic.
Well,
or did they think of it in terms of magic?
They did, it seems. I mean, there's a good article on erotic magic. There's a good historian of magic at Northwestern University, Richard Kieheffer, and he's written a lot about medieval magic. He has a book called Medieval Magic, which is really helpful as a general introduction, and he's also written about erotic magic in the Middle Ages. And so as soon as you say the word magic, people bring in a lot of associations with it. And it's true. It's a huge subject, and it's quite complicated. So what would have been considered magic in the Middle Ages is a very hard question to answer, and what would be considered magic today is also equally complicated. So when we're talking about the pharmacology, there are other things sometimes. For example, there are incantations that people may say when they gather herbs, for example, that could be considered magic. And there are some that the church approves of, and there are others that the church does not approve of at this time. And that at this time, the church has not yet taken the strong position it will take later, say in the 15th century. It is certainly against magic, but magic has not become the sharp focus that it will become later. So the church wants people to say the right incantations, the right prayers when they gather herbs. And so the church describes what it is doing in some ways as a kind of magic, but it's supported by good forces as opposed to what it defines as evil forces. And these definitions are not cut and dried, and they're constantly changing, and there are church figures at the time who disagree on them. So there's no one answer. So the question of were they using really magic, it depends on how you define it. And so many people define it so many different ways, and I think one of the things that's important to realize is that there's no one definition for the Middle Ages. It's constantly changing.
Okay. Well, and I'm thinking, too, about, you know, getting into the burning times.
Okay.
Is that like the backdrop for any of this, or does that factor into, the women healers or anything like that? I mean, is there an association with what happened with the burning times and in your subject matter?
I think that there's probably less of one than people might assume. I think that the real watershed moment that leads to that is in the late 15th century, when you have the publication of this text called the Hammer of Witches. Malleus Maleficarum is the Latin name. And so when this text is written by a church figure and it becomes a part of the understanding of magic and the church's resistance and fight against it at the time, what happens is this text is, it makes a, the first time, before this, this is not an idea that's standard, but this text makes a really strong link between women, between Satan, demons, sexuality, and magical practices. And before
that's still
that,
going on today by evidence
right.
of my opening comments.
Sure. And so before that, those links were not nearly that strong. And the best analysis of this is a book called The Magician, the Witch, and the Law that was written by Edward Peters a number of years ago. And there's been some more recent work on it. And it really talks about how in the 15th century you have this rise in interest in demons and demonology, and you get this really tight link between women and Satan and what witchcraft as being a form of demonology, and it gets linked to sexuality. So before that, so it's really helpful for people to understand that has not been the concept of magic forever. That is can be located in a specific point in time, and there are negative aspects that derive out of it. And of course, the witch persecutions and trials of the 16th and 17th century only get cranked up after these texts and those really strong associations are made. And so historians have made the case that is one of the major factors that enabled those persecutions to take place.
The publication of that book.
Yes.
Okay.
And the ideas around it and how it became accepted and moved forward. Yes.
I don't mean to get off subject, but how long did it take for that book to take hold and make such a, and be so effective? I mean, are we talking decades?
50 years, probably.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the incantations for a minute, because you said that, that people might have used incantations as they're gathering herbs, and the church didn't care so much as long as it was the right incantations. It makes me think about how Christians came in and co-opted pagan sacred sites, for instance,
sure.
or even Mardi Gras. I mean, I'm from New Orleans, and Mardi Gras has pagan roots, and, we learned there, it's a good example of what the Christians couldn't co-opt and take over and change. I mean, what they couldn't change, they really just sort of co-opted. And,
right.
It became a syncretized thing. So would you say, for instance, that would it be not a leap in logic to say that the church wanted the incantations to be about God and Jesus, where before it might have been about, the green man and goddess or something like that?
Right. I would have to say that I don't know enough about it, really, to say. They're probably the best person. Valerie Flint wrote a book on, it's simply called The Rise The Rise of Magic in Early Medieval Europe, and she talks about the specifics, but I haven't looked at it in a while. But she does talk about pretty small differences between what was acceptable and what was not acceptable, and how the church takes a role against certain things but lets other things go. So I can't give as much of a detailed answer on that one as I'd like to.
Okay, okay. Well, now, in your book, you discuss the legend of Tristan and Isolde, and you mentioned them a little bit, but are they important, to talk more about in relationship to this topic?
So the thing about the story is that it's the great story of the love potion, because what happened is we have this young woman who has been betrothed to a king for political reasons, and so her mother, who is the same woman who healed Tristan from his wound, her mother in secret prepares a drink that she gives to Isolde's lady-in-waiting, and the lady-in-waiting is supposed to serve this drink in the evening of the first, after the wedding, to the new couple. And it is supposed to ensure a happy union. And so she entrusts this drink to the lady-in-waiting, tells no one else. Well, what happens is Isolde goes on aboard ship. Tristan had been sent as the emissary from his uncle, the king, that Isolde is to marry. And he had been sent to ask for her hand in marriage and to bring her to Cornwall, where the marriage will take place. So Isolde goes with her lady-in-waiting, and that's the only person that will go with her to this strange land. She's supposed to marry a man who she's never seen before in her entire life. And obviously this would be a really stressful situation. And so we know already that her mother is very knowledgeable about plants, about poisons, about anti-venom, these different kinds of things. So when a number of literary critics have written about this love potion, as I said before, as a literary scholar, I'm in dialogue with these other critics, and all of them have said, well, love potions don't exist. They're impossible. This is totally imaginary. But here we have this woman who obviously knows a lot about the virtues of plants. And so what I argued in the book is, no, it's completely believable that she would prepare something, a beverage made with wine and spices, and add to it plant extracts that would be helpful on this first very stressful night together with this new husband. So anything that would relax, anything that would lower inhibitions, anything that would promote a sense of well-being, anything that would promote a sense of euphoria. So these, having a sense of well-being and euphoria, are also synonymous with the chemistry, the brain chemistry of falling in love. And so the whole point of this potion is to help them through this transitional evening. The problem is that it doesn't get served on the wedding night. Tristan and Isolde find it on the boat one day before they arrive in Cornwall, and they are thirsty and it's hot, and they drink it, and they fall head over heels in love. And people say, well, that's just ridiculous. You can't, no drink could do this. Again, we have to look back at the story and see what the context for it was. Before Tristan and Isolde drank the love potion, they had spent a considerable amount of time together, as it turns out. While Tristan was being healed by her mother, he had given her lessons in music, and he had taught her literature. He had had these courtly skills that were valued at the court, and he had taught them to the princess. And so they had spent a lot of time together. They're both about the same age. They're both described as physically very either handsome or beautiful. So they have everything in place that could facilitate them falling in love. The problem is that she is, of course, betrothed to Tristan's uncle for these political reasons. So when they drink the love potion, which, if I described it correctly, as something that lowers inhibitions, promotes a feeling of euphoria, they are able to voice their love, and then they immediately consummate it. So they arrive at Cornwall, and she goes ahead and marries King Mark immediately, but the two of them are head over heels in love, and they will continue to have to meet up and have these trysts, and this will cause huge rifts at the court, because it's in fact treason. What they're doing is against the king, and so it's even more serious than just a regular affair. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, does the text say what was in the potion, or that's always just sort of left wide open?
It says it's a mixture of wine and spices,
and
that she prepared it. The text never lists any kind of, other than wine and spices, they never list any ingredients, but they will talk in detail, or not in detail, but they will give some description about brewing, mixing, gathering, you know, planning, that it's a process. It's not just, you know, something quick and easy or anything like that. There's clearly some learning, clearly some thought, some awareness, some planning that goes into the whole process.
Okay.
So we never are told specifics about ingredients, which is interesting.
Well, and I couldn't help but think, you know, as I'm listening to you, all the other concoctions that could be made, you know, that she could make the king, you know, impotent,
sure,
you know, or something like that, you know, so that she would never have to, you know, consummate the marriage,
right.
You know, if she really loves somebody else. I mean, the possibilities are just endless when you realize that maybe, you know, they had a medicine chest full of things to call on.
Right.
Okay.
And some of them would work better than others, obviously. And one of the things that writers note is that if you are working from plants as opposed to synthetics derived from that are used for modern drugs, is that with the effectiveness of the plant material can vary from plant to plant. So sometimes it might be less effective than other times.
Mm-hmm.
So it's inherently less exact than working with synthetics. But as everyone knows, plants do have effects on people.
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes me think about one of the theories, you know, for the burning times was that some of these, you know, axe people were accused of doing, you know, the ergo or something like that, the mold that was growing on the...
Right, the plant on the wheat, I think, maybe, or something.
Yeah, that they thought that could, at least in, you know, in some places, that could have been, you know, would attributed some of the behavior of some of the people, was, you know, do that mold on their food.
Right.
Well, now, the Tristan story, I believe in some of the information you sent me, you say it's important to other texts, or the abilities of the healers or the love magicians, you know, they, you know, they're important in other stories as well, or?
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. In fact, what happens often in medieval literary texts is they are adaptations, rewrites, transformations of earlier stories. So at this time, people don't particularly value complete and total originality, but they want rewrites. So as it turns out, there are lots of translations of the Tristan story, but there are also a lot of stories that start from it but vary widely. And the interesting thing is what happens, of course, at the end of the Tristan and Isolde story is that they die because they cannot survive. He is eventually banished from the court, and they cannot survive apart from each other because they are, as you said, soulmates. And so in the other stories, people are responding to the fact that they wanted something other than this tragic ending. The other stories have happy endings, and there are various different ways of rewriting the story. So one that's a little bit less known but is really a fascinating story is called The Romance of Silence, and it's a two-part romance. So the first part deals with the parents, and the second part deals with the child, who's called Silence. And Silence is interesting for a number of reasons that I didn't go into in my book, because Silence is actually, or in French, Silence, is the girl who was raised as a boy. So we have this child in medieval times who was brought up for all the world to see as a boy because of inheritance rules of the time. And the first part of the story is a kind of rewrite of the Tristan and Isolde story, because it's the parents, and we see them falling in love, and we see them having the same kind of trepidation and not being able to speak of their love. And then they have this moment where they overcome their fears, and they're able to grow close to each other because, again, the knight is wounded in battle by a poison wound, and the young woman, who again is considered very wise in the land, the wisest doctor in the land, comes to heal them, and as a result of the healing time, they spend time together, and then they fall in love. So the story of silence is a really fascinating story, and one that has a lot of ideas in it that people are surprised took place in the Middle Ages. I also mentioned Cligès, which is written by the important romance writer Chrétien, Chrétien de Troyes, so Christian of Troy is his English pronunciation, and he had also written a romance of Lancelot and Guinevere, and he also wrote the first of the Grail romances, and in this one, again, we have the story of the young woman who is married against her will, against her wishes for the man that she loves, and the potions that intervene, and so medieval audiences clearly were fascinated with this story of these people that fall in love and what will the society do with them, and they want a story with a happy ending because these other rewrites of the story all include the happy ending.
Well, was there ever a version of Lancelot and Guinevere that had a happy ending?
That one I don't think so. Except maybe First Night, the Hollywood the movie version
right,
that came
right,
out in the
right,
90s.
Right. So your
where
point
Sean Connery
is,
gives up the girl.
Yeah, gives up the girl, yeah. That was always a favorite story of mine, and it always just broke my heart at the end, you know.
Right.
I mean, you could just feel everyone's pain, you know. I mean,
right.
But anyway, so it seems like what you're saying, and forgive me if I've been a little thick on this, but this idea of healing and this idea of what they call love magic, these were like primary aspects of these stories. It's like if you wanted to have a popular, a popular story, it had to have these elements in it. Is that the right assumption?
Well, medieval romance is huge. There are so many. I mean, these definitely, there are many, many, many. I mean, we have a whole set of different tellings of, you know, what are called the Grail romances. And when the Grail was first written about, it's not holy. It's simply a dish. And then it becomes the Holy Grail, and they're questing after the Grail. So that's a whole other subset. And there are many other stories, again, of different kinds of intrigue at court. So I really did work on quite a small subset of them. But because they were connected together and because they had such impact for the ideas that show up, like I said earlier, in our thoughts today and how we talk about love. So
right.
They're important, but they're not. There's a lot more out there as well.
So, did you have some sort of compelling conclusion after you did this wealth of research?
The thing that really jumped out at me is the assumptions that the critics had made about these women. They had just completely overlooked them. They had said, you know, these women were not practicing legitimate medicine. Men practiced legitimate medicine. Women did not. Without looking at what was going on at the time. And so the really important thing is to question the assumptions that people have about women's knowledge and how they can apply it to influence the world that they live in. And so I really see this as part, my work as part of the feminist project of documenting what women knew, how they knew it, why it was important, and what agency it gave to them in the world.
Yeah, because, you know, that's what that's what I've always heard too, even though, you know, I do read feminist stuff and women's studies, that, you know, the men were the doctors and the women were several rungs below. But you're saying what you found in your book, that in that that medical college, women actually attended.
Well, at this time, it's before the university gets started. So the University of Paris is founded in the year 1200, and it doesn't really, there's no documentation that medicine is taught there until about 1230. So once medicine is taught at the university, women cannot study at the university.
Well, what were they doing before? What were they doing for the first 30 years?
They were teaching, grammar, rhetoric, logic, that kind of thing. And then you.
So women could attend those classes, but not medicine.
No, it was actually the fact that women couldn't attend university. Before universities were founded, there were cathedral schools, and women studied at convents. And so both boys and girls were educated at cathedral schools. But there wasn't as much study of medicine until beginning in the 13th century. So medicine is studied. There was a school of medicine in Salerno in Italy. But one of the things that's important to realize is before medicine really becomes a university subject, it's probably taught more as through apprenticeship than it is through schools. And so girls did have access to education before the university, but women are formally excluded from the university. And some girls will continue to study. They will study on their own. They will study at convents. But the founding of the university excludes women from a huge amount of developing knowledge. And of course,
so how did they get away with that? I mean, what excuse did they give?
It was a part of the church, and so you had to take minor clerical orders in order to study at the university, and only men could do that. They never set out to say women can't study here. But what they did do was, as a function of, it seemed like a matter of course to them that now that we're incorporating the university through the church, you have to take the step, which is part of the church hierarchy, and only men can take that step.
Okay. For my listeners, what do you hope the listeners take away from what we've discussed tonight?
Well, I think, again, the most important thing is to question the assumptions about women's knowledge, that these women were on equal footing with the male practitioners of the time, and that they practiced in much the same way. Things will change very quickly. They will change in the 13th century. As medicine enters into medical schools, it will become more theoretical. They will change in the 14th century as medicine professionalizes. But especially in the 12th century, these women are practicing in much the same way as university or school-trained doctors of the time, and not to make assumptions about the knowledge that they have, because they are as well-trained and as effective as the male practitioners of the time.
Okay. Well, so what else are you working on, Lane? Do you have something, now that the book is out, and, what's your next project?
I'm really still very much interested in this whole question of knowledge and how it's defined and how it is considered, what counts as knowledge. So I'm going to be looking at women at specifically around the time of the rise of the University of Paris and how they're represented and how their knowledge is represented. Because when women get shut out of the university, learning for women in Europe becomes a private matter and it changes. What power does the university have by becoming the institution that it does? How does it define learning? How does it define what's acceptable? This kind of thing. So I'm still very much vested in the question of women's knowledge, women's learning, and how it's perceived as legitimate or illegitimate.
So would I be would it be right to assume that these women that did have access to knowledge, that this was probably women who had money, women of the aristocracy, rather than just your average, everyday, I don't know if there was such a thing as a middle class?
Well, the middle class does develop throughout the Middle Ages, but it is mainly the aristocracy. And then as the middle class develops, they will have access sometimes to writing usually not in Latin, but either in French or English, depending on where they are, that kind of thing. So especially for this time period, the best information that we have is often about the aristocracy only.
Okay, yeah, you mentioned that earlier. Well, is there anything I didn't think to ask you that would be something important, related to the subject?
Well, if people want to buy the book, they can go to the Penn State Press website or to Amazon. And so we've really only touched on about a third of what's in there. So if people are interested, it is available, and I encourage them.
Okay. Well, just to give a little dangle a carrot a little bit more. What other things are in the book that the listeners might find tantalizing?
So further details on the stories really kind of hit that pretty quickly. A lot more background on magic and medicine at the time, these practices. Huge amount of bibliography on medieval magic if people want to follow up on that. And questions about women's knowledge and learning at the time and what was considered the most important. So there are a number of threads and areas of interest that people might want to follow up on.
Okay. Well, and you mentioned a couple titles. You said The Rise of Magic in Western Europe, I think.
It's early medieval Europe, yeah.
Early medieval Europe. You said The Magician, The Witch, and The Law,
I think,
was another book. But, of course, yours, Love Cures, Healing and Love Magic in Old French Romance. Well, Lane, it's really been intriguing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for
kind of giving us a little glimpse into this, into this time period, into the lives of these women. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, good night, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Let me know if you'd like to come back on the show with any new material you'd like to present.
Great. Thank you very much. Good night.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, the resurging interest in right brain thinking. Some call it the feminine consciousness. I like to call it the great she, and she wears a crown. In that crown, she's got three gems, deity, archetype, and ideal, and how the great she, how her values and benchmarks can help us save the world. And you've been listening to Lane Doggett, professor at St. Mary's College of Maryland, discussing healing and love magic in the 12th and 13th centuries. Interesting stuff, for sure. Well, as many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, the religion of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, well, women in their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority, it was thwarted. They were repressed. Their authority became taboo. Their very lives were diminished and disrespected. Well, that's why here on the show I'm dedicated to recovering the great she in all her many faces and facets, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, me and my beloved guests, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past so that we know why things are the way they are today, how they've come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural, and we are going about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, I think we have no other choice. And if women want to be free in this society, if they want to be equal in this society, we have no other choice. If we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, it's women with our like-minded brothers armed with ideals of the sacred feminine who will set things back on course. I like to read that. I feel like I'm being cheerleader for the sacred feminine, for goddess and the show. And our mottos, let me read them. First, truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. That's from author Schopenhauer, 19th century philosopher. And Gandhi, more contemporary times, he says, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Well, in just a minute, we're going to bring on Zee Budapest and her partner, Bobby Grenier, to discuss the status of the Merlin Stone tribute. But first, just a couple quick things. I want to remind you that airtime here on Blog Talk, it's not free anymore. And I am asking for your support to keep the show on the air. I'm going to give you a free gift if you help support the show with any contribution you can make. If you can send in as much as $100, I'll send you my 3D set of radio shows when I was on CBS discussing with other goddess advocates sacred places of goddess around the world. You can get this nowhere else but from me direct. It doesn't live in any archive. And if you donate less than $100, which is certainly welcome, $5 or $10, it all helps. It all adds up. I'll send you some other thank you gifts. And please remember, whether it's the first time you've heard or not, you know, like Goddess teaches us, what you tend to, what you nurture, what you nourish, it thrives. What you neglect, well, it withers. And I want to take a minute to thank those of you who have already sent in donations. And if you'd like to do that, I would recommend you just go to my website, KarenTate.com, and on the button that says Goddess Store, just click that button. It will take you to the Goddess Store, where you can read about the books and the free downloadable meditations that's there, and beautiful postcards of sacred sites, lots of cool things there. Anyway, if you go all the way down to the bottom, there are PayPal buttons where you can make some sort of a contribution to the show in any amount you can afford. So thank you very much for considering it. Also, while you're here on what they call my show page, I'm sure you're looking at it, and maybe if you're listening, remember the three F's. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend and click follow. That's the three F's, favorite, friend, follow. And if you click the follow button, you'll never miss notice of who my new guest is each week. That way you're part of our growing family of listeners across the globe, because sometimes I don't get a chance to send out an email reminder, and that way you won't miss out. What else? Oh, also, too, I would love it if you would put some comments on the show page there about some of the shows you're listening to, if you like them or not. Okay, so let's see. Is there anything else? Yes, free stuff, like I briefly alluded to, free stuff on my website, downloadable meditations, again, on the Goddess Store page of my website. And there's a new article posted on the articles page on my website that ran in an international magazine called La Luz. The article is titled "The Inhumanity of the GOP, Always for Profits, Not People." And can't we just see that playing out all over the news, all over the country, as they use the deficit and the debt ceiling as an excuse to take rights away from workers, to try to repeal child labor laws, to do away with the minimum wage, Social Security, Medicare. Don't even get me started on how they're trying to decimate women's rights to their own bodies, all the while crying about regulation to keep the environment clean, to keep the bankers from robbing us blind, or the oil companies from destroying our ecosystems. So don't forget, for future shows, you can email me questions in advance if you don't want to talk live, or you can always call in. And I see our second guests they're patiently waiting, and I thank them for their patience. If you'd like to call in and talk to Zee or Bobby, the call-in number is 718-766-4662. So I am going to go in right now and say hello to these ladies. Hi, Zee, Bobby, you guys there?
Yes, we are.
Hello, hello.
Well, good. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really want to hear how the Merlin Stone tribute is going. Why don't you fill us in on the progress since the last time we talked?
Well, since we last talked with you, we had an appointment with a wonderful lady, Rian Eisler. Rian Eisler appears like the perfect lady, totally perfect lady, and it took a little bit of talking with her to loosen her up. She was a little bit too perfect, and then it went very well. And indeed, in The Chalice and the Blade, she has Merlin Stone mentioned as one of the great influences on her work, and she has worked a lot. She gave me some books. They are so thick. I'm taking them on the airplane to Glastonbury, where we are continuing In Search of Merlin Stone, interviewing women in Europe now who, what do we have? You go.
We'll interview Kathy Jones, who's the hostess of the Goddess Conference in Glastonbury. And Lady Olivia Robertson will be there, and we will interview her. And Anik Radiant Heart, who's right now down in your area in Southern California, but she's going to be at Glastonbury as well. So when we meet up there, we'll interview her. And And then I think I'm just going to make the rounds and listen to what women have to say about the impact of Merlin's, you know, work on them and the influences, and take a lot of footage of the wonderful pageantry at this particular goddess conference.
Well, Bobby, I had such a wonderful time when you were, you know, at my place, and it was such an honor to be included in this tribute. I want to thank you both for that. And I know you've traveled on the East Coast already. You've come, you know, down south on the West Coast. I'm sure you've gone even beyond that. This has got to be costing you guys an arm and a leg. What can listeners do to help you finance this tribute to Merlin? Because it's certainly such a worthy project. How can we not do this? I mean, you know, we owe this to her as women. We owe this to her as goddess advocates. What can we do to help you?
Well, we've got a couple ways that everyone, not just the women, everyone can help if they want to. And one is that we have a Kickstarter fundraiser going live, and that's at Kickstarter.com. And if you go there, and you can get the link off MerlinStone.net website, or you can go to Kickstarter.com and then just search on Merlin Stone, and you'll find it. We set the goal as $5,000, but we do need a lot more than that to make this all happen, because this project has like three components to it. But anyhow, we're about 51% funded right now. It would be awesome reach that goal of $5,000 and more. With Kickstarter, you have to at least reach your minimum goal. For us, that's $5,000. Otherwise, you don't get anything. So it's kind of an all-or-nothing proposition, and that's why it's so important to step up and help donate. Since we're 51% of the way there, you know, it would be great to get all the way there and then some. The other way, Kickstarter works with Amazon's donation system, and some people out there aren't hooked up to that. So another way to help is to donate directly through PayPal, the Women's Spirituality Forum, is set up with PayPal, and that would be WSF for Women's Spirituality Forum, WSF@zbudapest.com. And if you want to do a direct donation that way, that's helpful. You can send us a check. And
all of these donations are tax deductible, right?
Absolutely, because all of the funds are going into the Women's Spirituality Forum, who is actually producing all of this. So, there's all kinds of ways. And even if you don't have the finances, help us out by spreading the word, you know, Twitter, and call friends, write letters, get on Facebook, whatever, LinkedIn. Help us to get the word out about the projects, because believe it or not, there are still a lot of people who are just now beginning to find out that Merlin Stone has passed, and that there's this big, gigantic, you know, celebration memorial going to happen in Florida on September 24th.
And, why don't you tell us more about that?
I would. I'm just now planning it step by step, but as far as I have gotten, it will be a very different ritual from what I usually do. And this will begin with solemnizing. We are solemn at the beginning, just very serious and solemn. And into that mood, we will interject some music, dirges that the Hecate's wheel will sing, and Ruth Barrett will also sing. And then we slowly lead the audience into what is remembered lives, what is remembered lives. What is remembered lives. And then first the family, first we show Merlin's DVD of her life, where we have pulled together where she worked, her statuary, her personal stuff. And then the family will speak. Her daughter from Paris sent us words that Bobby recorded, and we can play that. This is Cynthia in Paris. She illustrated Ancient Mirrors of Womanhood. Then her widow will speak briefly, and whoever was very close to her, I really don't know how I'm going to line them up until I'm there and see who actually showed up. And then we open up for grieving. The grieving is recalling times with her, anybody who's got a good story about her, to elevate her spirit, to make her feel that we understood her importance. She's done a good job with her life, giving us this knowledge, and we are ever so grateful, and we stand taller because she has given back women's past, which meticulously was stolen. Sometimes she found just a line or two in one book and then found a little snippet of a poem in another one, and she had to connect the dots between these remnants that the destroyer somehow got lazy about, and it remained. And that's really how it is with the past of more than half of humanity. It has been eradicated. The Temple of Eleusis, where it was like our Vatican back then, was razed to the ground, burned down, and then salt strewn in the on the entire area so nothing would grow. And these are just in addition to having some kind of religious Christian frenzies, and they were chopping off the breasts of the goddess statues and the arms and the heads. So we have a lot of headless goddesses, armless goddesses. When you look at those beautiful works that remain, just know great artists are our ancestors. We come from fine, high-cultured civilization. When our values, goddess values, peace, good times, culture was what we debated and how to do it, we had a good life. We allowed everyone's life to unfold without violence. Nobody was killed. Well, I suppose people died suddenly from accidents, but there were no wars. Today, we are coming back to that knowledge, and even some men are coming around that when they really look at what do wars get us? Well, they get us famine. They get us our children in body bags. They get us a lot of weeping widows and orphans, and both sexes are killed there, so we're losing mothers. And what do we get at the end? Nothing.
Unless you're the military-industrial complex, see?
Yes, yes. That whole thing really has to be gone. There is a better life if we don't want to dominate over other countries and mind our own beeswax, for heaven's sakes. Build up this gorgeous country to some civilized level when there'd be no graffiti around. People would be not angry. The young people would see some future. We would have some other way to deal with crime. A woman's values is what patriarchy hates most of all. They say, oh, we love women. We just don't want them to be free. We don't want them to have choice over their bodies. We don't want them to have anything to say about war or peace, because they would never have wars then. This actually happened to me when I was speaking. I said, you know, women need to lead the country. A life and death must be in the hands of women, whose business it is with our species' life and death. And some youngster, just a young boy, cried out from, oh, but then we will never be at war, he said, worried. And I said, yeah, and you can live your entire life undisturbed and receive your entire destiny.
Right, yeah, not worried about whether he's going to get maimed or be a fodder for some cannon. Well, Ziba, getting back to the tribute for Merlin, I know you mentioned it last time on the show, but in case some of the listeners missed it, what's the date and what's the location in Florida, and is there a plan for anybody that maybe can't come to Florida but maybe wants to, you know, do some sort of attunement with you with their own groups and, you know, in distant locations? Or can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, hush up, Puffy. I think I'll speak to that one.
Yeah, Bobby.
But you know, before I forget, the part Z kind of stepped away from there on the memorial, is that she's going to work it towards, you know, this is a celebration. There's going to be, towards the end of it, lots of music and more of a
goddess rock and roll.
Yeah, goddess rock and roll, happy, joy, joy.
And hot food and a good time. So the last part is celebration.
Okay. So the to answer your question, though, we're going to be videotaping this whole thing. So part of the parts that we can use for the documentary will be in there. So those who attend expect to be videotaped. But also what we're going to be doing is, because we've got this nice high technology church in Clearwater, Florida, we're going to hook up a computer, and I have a high definition wide angle camera that should be able to show you the whole church, what's going on inside. And the nice part is that inside the church there's a really large screen that we can shoot a camera onto whoever is talking or performing or whatever's going on, and it'll show up on the big screen, so you'll be able to see it from your computer as long as you can hook up to Ustream. And you should be able to see it. And some of the groups around globally will be picking up on this live streaming video. And they're going to get together their groups, and they're going to do their own memorial celebration with us. So they'll have it up on a big screen. They'll hook up a TV or something like that to it so that everybody can see. Some of them are going to have a high tea. Others are going to, you know, just do their own maybe ritual while we're doing it, and just go along with us. So whether you're in a group, you have a coven, you have a women's circle, you have a class, I've talked to some of the teachers, some of the women we've interviewed even are talking about getting their classrooms together so that they can view it all together. And or if you're just an individual and you want to watch it, we're trying to make this globally accessible to all women so that everyone can have this experience in remembering, you know, those who have passed on, remembering Merlin and the other women who've passed on, and also so that all of us have an opportunity to look around the room and see who's still standing, because there's a lot of foremothers that actually are still with us that we're not taking advantage of. We've kind of forgotten them somehow. And I think that that's the most important thing to come out of this, is that it's not okay to forget your foremothers, your forefathers. We need to recognize those people, and they still have they have more knowledge in their little finger than most of us do, and we're not taking advantage of it.
Well, Bobby, I think that's an awesome thing you're doing, hooking this up to Ustream so, I mean, everybody can watch it in real time. And you know what? You just made me think, you know, these foremothers, you say that, you know, we're sort of not taking advantage of their knowledge. Please give me, you know, send me some of their names. Maybe I can also, get them, on the radio show.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to do that. I'll email you.
And again, it's going to be in Clearwater, Florida, and what's the date again?
It's going to be on September 24th, which is a Saturday. It's going to be at the Unitarian Church in Clearwater, Florida, which is about 15 minutes or so outside Tampa. And if you go to merlinstone.net, and you'll have to look at the postings that I have there or different pages that I have, because I'm posting information as quickly as I can. But I have resources like hotels in the area if you need to make a reservation. And the exact location of the church and all of that. In fact, I can pull that up while you and Z are talking if you like.
Well, and
I'm very
excited. When I went to that Kickstarter site to actually make my donation, people do get, free thank you gifts for making donations as well. So they do get something in return besides the, you know, having the pride that they contributed to this.
They do. Okay, I've got the address for you. The exact address is the Unitarian Universalist of Clearwater. The address is 2470 Nursery Road in Clearwater, Florida. And, yeah, on the Kickstarter, that's what I love about Kickstarter, is that we give away like goodies and prizes almost for, you know, it's kind of like how the public broadcasting system does the donating, you know, help funding public broadcasting, and then they give you something, you know, of nice value. But you donate a little bit extra more than what it's actually worth. But it's kind of cool. You get something back. And we really gave some thought to, you know, what do we want to give back to the community? So we've got quite a list of things there. And at $50, you'll actually get a copy of the documentary when we're finished with it. So I think that that's a cool price point. The other one thing that you'll probably notice is, like, right next to it is a donation amount of $51. And what I did with that is, for those who want to come to the memorial, if you donate any of the amounts that have the $1 with them, like, you know, $101 or something like that, then you get a reserved seat at the memorial service. And it also gives us a heads up as to, you know, how many attendees we're expecting. And along those lines, we're also talking to, if you are in Florida and hear this, we're looking for the occult shops, the covens there, you know, in the area, who wants to get involved, who wants to attend. I think you should get a hold of us, because we have a small group there that's working, their whole coven is working, trying to help us, and that's the wonderful women from Hakate's Wheel that we have to turn all of you goddess women onto. If you haven't heard their music, you should. It's amazing. And
well, you know, Bobby, Selena Fox has a directory out that lists pagan groups all over the country. I'm just wondering, she's probably got to have some groups down there in Florida. Maybe that could be a resource for you as well. Yeah,
she does, and I could do, Witch Fox as well.
Right.
But it'd be better if they contact me, because I'm crazy busy with all of this.
Well, or do you need any volunteers? I mean, is that also help you need, or is at this point it's just the money to keep this thing funded?
Well, volunteers have to be there in Florida. So we're talking about Floridians or people who would drive down there for the event. We'd be there a week earlier because we are interviewing Lenny, the widow, and then we go to the place proper, and we're going to have rehearsals because this is a very new ritual that I'm creating, and I want it to be seamless, like my work normally is.
Said she modestly. Of course.
I don't want to lose that standard.
Can I interject?
Yes,
just to kind of put it out there, some of the women who have already are already making their plane reservations. Selena Fox is attending. Ruth Barrett is attending. Susan Weed is coming down from New York. Barbara Walker is going to attend, and bless her soul, 81 years old. And
she's going to make the pilgrimage.
She's making the pilgrimage. We're sending we have a volunteer who's gone to get her, and who will go to get her at the time and bring her. Who else is coming? I'm not sure yet. I think Donna Hennis was talking about coming down, and we're still waiting to hear from, like, Margot Adler and others. And when we were in New York and interviewing Gloria Steinem, she told us that if her schedule had changed a little bit from she was supposed to be out of the country. She said that if it continues this way, she was going to make every effort to come as well.
Wow. Well, let me ask you a couple questions, Bobby, as you've been doing these interviews. Has there been anything that's popped out at you that you maybe want to share with listeners, or surprised you, or, I don't know, made you feel proud, or, you know, what can you say that you've uncovered?
Well, I'm actually at this point, I'm overwhelmed by the amount of information and the story of Merlin Stone's life in general. I'm having such a on one hand, this is a very, very hard, difficult assignment and taxing time-wise and energy-wise. But on the other hand, it's an amazing journey that I personally get to go on and interview all of these fabulous women who have stories that just rock my world, to be honest with you. I've learned so much about women's spirituality and things that I didn't know, things that I hadn't even imagined, and things that go beyond just the story of Merlin Stone. Lots of these women have really wanted to open up and just talk about women's spirituality in general, because they're just as hungry to talk about it as we are to hear about it. And, you know, for a lot of the older women, for whatever reason, the younger generations have just kind of like dropped them. And here they are with all this knowledge, and they're bursting at the seams to tell somebody about it. And I probably have enough information to make about, you know, 3 documentaries in total, to be honest with you, out of all of these interviews. The stories that they're telling me are eye-opening, and I want to share those with the rest of the world. So I've got my work cut out for me there. Plus, a lot of these women want to tell more information than what I can possibly put in the documentary, and that's why we're going to do a companion book, provided we get enough funds. I think I'll just also call it In Search of Merlin Stone, because it kind of makes sense that they go together. But what I would like the companion book to be is articles by all of these women where they got to tell their full story, say their full, you know, their full truth, and then to also have some unpublished work by Merlin Stone that Lenny, her widow, has put in our hands. And then, you know, a few other things like that. And just put out a book that really talks to Merlin's body of work and Merlin and all the stories and women's spirituality in general, and get that out there into the public. Because I think we have an obligation at this point to not only educate ourselves now, but we have to provide materials that educate on into the future. And that's what we're really attempting to do here.
And maybe inspire some of the younger women, you know, to take up the torch. Well, let me ask either of you, whoever feels you can answer this, if you can. I know you've been so busy. I don't know if this has even come up, but I'm curious. When you spoke to Merlin's widow, Lenny, or anyone that was maybe close to her, and you know, in the last maybe decade of her life, did she know how important she was? Did she have a sense of the contribution she made?
I'm very sure that she did. She did. She was very modest about it. When I met her in person, of course, I was all over myself with adoration for her. And then she says, "Oh, don't do that just because I wrote a book. It's what it's about. It's not about me. It's about what I have recaptured." And I said, "Yes, we know, but it took you to recapture it. It was you who went around and slept in caves and pulled it together and connected the dots." So I was quite a fan, and then she just graciously left me until I got over it. but well, now the second time, I want to tell you a story that I learned through these interviews. I've forgotten who told me this about that. It could have been Rianne, that when she was looking for information, sometimes a book would literally fall on her head.
A lot of the, you were asking what was shocking, I suppose. Almost every woman that I spoke with had a different Merlin Stone story about something that we might call more supernatural that happened to Merlin. Merlin was definitely someone who was guided by the other side.
And protected.
And protected, yes, deeply protected. And it what was interesting was that all of these women had different stories. I mean, I think that only once did I ever hear a story repeat about, like, you know, like there's one story that Merlin, she just was kind of thinking maybe she wouldn't do this, you know, and she went to the grocery store, and there in the middle of the floor in the grocery store is a book, and it's open to a page of the goddess that she was looking for, which is why she thought she would just let it go, because she couldn't find this one obscure reference to this goddess. And here it was on the floor in the middle of the grocery store.
I know. I mean, how often do you see goddess books sprawled out on the grocery store floor? Why didn't I promise that?
Sprawled was good.
Good, I nailed it. Good.
That's a wonderful story. And those are the sorts of stories that are going to be in the documentary.
Yeah. And I like to have a call out to also our sisters around the globe, not just in our country, if you hear us, to tie in. The goddess movement is far less visible in Europe, except for Kathy Jones Glastonbury. And then the Nordic women used to have big lesbian gatherings or all women gatherings, and they had a large part of it involved with spirituality. I don't know if that's still going on. We'll learn about Europe week after next.
Can I add one thing? You were asking if Merlin knew her impact. And one of the things that we're working on with Lenny, actually, the widow, is that before Merlin passed away, he showed her the website for, I think it's greatwomen.org, which is the Women's Hall of Fame here in the United States. And he asked her, do you want to be in this? And at that point, she couldn't communicate anymore except for like squeezing his hand, and they had little hand signals, and she squeezed his hand for yes. So she understood that her body of work was important enough to put her in, you know, that category. And we're actually working right now with the women in the Susan B. Anthony Coven number one are trying to help us to get Merlin into the women's archives and the, you know, the National Registry of Important Women. So
is that a big process? Is that a difficult process to be accepted?
Well, it is, in the sense that there's a lot of documentation. We have to essentially document her whole life and her body of work. And I think what we're going to do is that the gals that are working on the paperwork side of it, you know, are doing that research right now. Part of it is, you know, we have to unearth Merlin's life, because she was a little bit reclusive. So it's been a little bit of a challenge to dig some of it up. And then I think what we'll do is, when the documentary is done, we'll just attach that, you know, and let them make a decision.
Right. That sounds perfect. Well, unless there's something else you want to add, the only other thing I thought listeners might want to know, for those of who are sort of coming into this a little bit late, when did she pass away, and how much do you feel comfortable saying about the nature of her illness?
Well, her illness was related to dementia. She fell down a lot. She lost motor skills, and then she had seizures. So at the end, she couldn't even swallow, and that is something that, you know, I wish that she just slumbered off in her sleep, as she deserved. But in fact, she was bedridden for 3 years. She got care. Two women looked after her who were very close to her and Lenny. And Lenny stayed with her all the 35 years together. They were never married, but they were. He totally supported her mission and totally followed. The man is an angel, all right? She had
Sounds
a good
like
guy,
it.
A very, very rare good guy. And she deserved it. So I guess the goddess gave her somebody good. That's a little lighter. I wanted her to go like Kate Gardner did. She took a nap and never got up. I think that's the most beautiful way to go. Well, we never know how the fates arrange these things.
And how old was she, Z, when she passed?
She was 78.
78, okay.
Well,
ladies, is there more you want to share about this?
Yes,
we still have
just
about
a little
10
bit
minutes.
More. Yes, but we can do a lot in 10 minutes. do not fear. we have what I like to see, those of you who know how to Twitter, get on Twitter and follow me, Z Budapest on Twitter. And respond and chat it up, a little one-liners. Merlin is remembered. Merlin is elevated. Merlin is the pilgrimage destination for all goddess women. We have to learn how to honor each other. This is such a terrible spiritual lack in something we call a spirituality movement. I mean, look at the entertainment. They honor each other left and right. Somebody picks up a mic and hands it over to somebody else, gets an Oscar. I mean, there are Emmys and Raspberries and Golden Globes, and every time you look around, that industry gets together, gets dressed up, and honors each other. What do? We have such heroic women amongst us still, and we have heroic women who have passed on just recently. To honor them is to honor ourselves. It really is about how much did we grow in our self-esteem? How much did we really heal ourselves from patriarchy? Could you please honor yourself? Can you applaud a sister's success? Can you say for any sister who gets ahead, get something good happens to her, yay, sister, something happened to you that affects me positively. That is my victory as well. These are the sentiments that need to be disseminated and mentioned to women, because they will remember. We used to be decent, civilized people, but now they are giving us attention when we attack each other, when we have artificially stirred up conflicts, when we accuse each other of all kinds of things. And, you know, from my point of view, all this is just yearning for recognition, yearning for each other's approval and each other's love. And unless we are willing to give ourselves what we give to men all the time. Oh, great professor, yes, I would take your course for millions of dollars because you're so smart and no woman can teach me. You know what I mean? This kind of delusion. To get over yourself and look at yourself, and we are in this unique universe. Remember, I always get back to the universe where we are utterly alone and we are teeming on this little rock. And guess who made that so? Women made it so. Everybody in our species came from us, emerged from us. We come from each other. This is a one species, and our species are represented by women and men who are, in my opinion, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I think men are a variation on women, not the other way around. So, this is what I try to initiate here. I would like us to learn now that we know that there are the holidays and the full moons and how good it is to ask for things and get it and move the spirit in our way. But where is the honoring? Where is the time when we get together and honor each other? Not because you have a birthday, that's your mother's honor. Your mother should be celebrated. Your mother should get a present and a cake. You know, you just came out and did that, and you got yourself a ticket to ride.
Yeah, but you just caused her a whole lot of pain. She is the one that deserves the cake.
I know. And we have social permission to celebrate birthdays. But we should have our own permission, our own social permission to celebrate each other for many, many reasons and be in a state of gratitude. Thank you for doing your radio show. Thank you, everybody who talks about the goddess. Thank you, every woman who calls another woman sister, even if you're not blood related. Thank you for looking at your screen and notice how women are treated in the media. Thank you for going and support women's films. There is a website that I go to, Women in Hollywood, and they always give you suggestions where the women's folk movies are playing. They are, you know, we have to find them. They are not pushing it on our faces. So this is what I want to do with this memorial. Develop a taste for honoring. Develop a taste for rejoicing for each other's lives and passing even. We all will die. I mean, this is just so. The spirit that is remembered, that left a rich legacy, ought to be elevated and talked to about some date during the year. Like this 24th is closest to her birthday on the 27th. She was a Virgo and devoted to the female principle of the universe. How destiny is that? So these are the things that I like to reintroduce into our public consciousness, the honoring each other, applauding each other. And anytime men want to bait you, oh, why don't you have a cat fight? Well, you have to tell them, get some cats, because there are no cats. Women are not cats. And if you want to see fight, why don't you fight some of dumb blowjoe yourself? Find somebody to fight. We're not interested. The entire idea, for example, of conflict is different for women than for men. When I watch television, all I see is the same old scenarios acted out over and over again. Here's a bunch of guys, here's another bunch of guys. This bunch of guys will blah blah us up the how unjust something happened, and these guys of guys will say, oh, we're going to kill the ones who don't like the injustice. And then, boom, there is a car chase, there's a very bad shootout scenes where nobody gets hit, minutes and minutes of total spraying with bullets each other. Nobody has a nick on them. They have to kill somebody eventually, so that one goes down, and then the rest of them run away because they were so heroic. This playing with death is sickening, sickening.
Yeah.
And making and turning death into entertainment is disrespectful. The way Shakespeare dealt with death, that death had still integrity, death had meaning, death was followed by feelings of loss. You look at the media, a woman is bumped off every segment. Then you just see her body on a slab and they discuss the wounds and everything. Hardly anybody gives any respect to her humanity. And why always female body cadavers? Why not? It's like 3-1. I counted it once. 3 times more female dead bodies are shown on the CSI shows than males. Why is that? Why is killing females more entertaining?
We have to start demanding more respect. And I think you're so right, Z. I mean, if women would start standing together, you know, we're more than half the population. We can make the world a better place, but first we have to stand together.
Yeah, estrogen poisoned. Too much
yes.
estrogen.
You're so funny. Well, I want to thank you both, Bobby and Z, for being on the show. And if it's helpful, I'm happy to have you back on again in August for another update right before you head to Florida. If you think it would help you reach your goals or you have new information
everything
you want to
helps.
Share.
Everything helps. Just talking to each other, hearing each other's voices. Who knows where else they hear. If you hear us, if you can, please send me an email. I want to hear from your listeners. This is too mysterious. I don't know where they are, who they are. I don't know how you get numbers up about them, but I know
they,
it's something.
They email me from all over. They do listen from across the globe. That I can promise you because I get the emails. I especially love the ones that say the show is a lifeline because they maybe, you know, live in some red state and they can't talk to anybody about the goddess. And, you know, just hearing other women and men talk about the goddess keeps them going. So, yeah, they're all over, Z.
Well, send me an email to zbudapest@gmail.com just so that I can thrill to this.
Okay.
Well, and one more time, merlinstone.net. Go there, click around, follow up, tweet, leave us some money.
And Bobby, how do they get to that Kickstarter site to leave money?
You know, I think the best way is to go to merlinstone.net. I've got it hooked up there. It's on the side, so you can link to it. But if you want to, you can go to Kickstarter.com and then search on Merlin Stone, and you'll find our project there with all the goodies that go along with donating.
Well, ladies, thank you so much. I know this is just an Amazonian effort you're both putting forth to make this happen for this worthy, worthy cause. So, you know, thank you. You know, thank you from the bottom of my heart. For the effort.
Blessed be great God.
And I'm sure I will talk to you both soon.
Blessed be great God. We love you.
Well, good night, ladies. Have a really good week. And you know, I hope you keep finding energy to keep you going.
Yep.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Well, for tonight's closing prayer, I'd like to share with you some sacred words, my dear listeners. I'd like to read this to you. It's from St. Hildegard von Bingen. And these are the words of Hildegard. It's from a book called Sister of Wisdom, St. Hildegard's Theology of the Feminine by Newman. And here are her words. She is divine wisdom. She watches over all people and all things in heaven and on earth, being of such radiance and brightness that for the measureless splendor that shines in her, you cannot gaze on her face or on the garment she wears. For she is awesome in terror as the thunder is lightning, and gentle in goodness as the sunshine. Hence, in her terror and her gentleness, she is incomprehensible to mortals because of the dread radiance of divinity in her face and the brightness that dwells in her as the robe of her beauty. She is like the sun, which none can contemplate in its blazing face or in the glorious garment of its rays, for she is with all and in all, and of beauty so great in her mystery that no one could know how sweetly she bears with people and with what unfathomable mercy she spares them. Isn't that beautiful? And finally, just a little quickie prayer from the Goddess Temple down in Orange County in Irvine. Every month we get a new prayer, and this one is the prayer for summer. And it goes like this. Great Goddess of all that is, I swoop and swish on the beauty currents of flow, knowing divine female presence as my essential nature. The great ocean of life holds me forever. I trust in her, and within her, I move easily through all time and space. I am so grateful for this peaceful power, for this serene joy, for this eternal, playful spirit. Blessed be. Well, listeners, next week we have on the show a woman by the name of Musawa, and she is hooked up with a beautiful publication that's been around for a really long time called We Moon. So I hope you'll tune in and hear what she has to say about women's spirituality, goddess spirituality, and the many years of doing that We Moon publication. And then on July 25th, on a Monday, a very special day. Our subject is going to be about bees. First, we're going to have Nancy Leetzo on the show. She's going to talk about colony collapse as it relates to the patriarchy. Very interesting stuff. And we're going to talk about bee priestesses. And then we're going to continue that conversation for a bit longer with a returning scholar who has been on the show several times, Marguerite Rigoglioso. And the subject will be more about bee priestesses. And then our final show in July will be with Professor Pamela Berger. She's going to talk about healing sanctuaries and healers, and part of the topic is how the sacred feminine went from grain goddess to saint, and I think that's going to be a really interesting show. So be with us next Wednesday, then July 25th, a Monday, and then the final Wednesday of the month, July 27th. So I'm going to close the show with a song that I feel is sort of appropriate for what Z and Bobby are actually doing, giving it back. So here's a song from Jeannie Privette Sable. She's been a guest on the show before, and she's allowed us to use her music. So here is Jeannie Privette Sable and the song Giving It Back. We'll let the song play through until we go off the air. Good night, listeners, and look forward to being with you next Wednesday. Have a great week.
Oh. Cash back.